War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. Part 2. After Prince Andrei's engagement to Natasha, Pierre suddenly, for no apparent reason, felt it impossible to go on living in the same way as before. Firm as his belief was in the truths revealed to him by his benefactor, the old Freemason, and happy as he had been at first in the task of perfecting his inner spiritual self, to which he had devoted himself with such ardour, yet, after Prince Andrei's engagement to Natasha and the death of Osip Alexeyevich, the news of which reached him almost simultaneously, the whole zest of his religious life seemed to have suddenly vanished. Nothing but the skeleton of life remained. His house, with his brilliant wife, now basking in the favours of a very grand personage indeed, the society of all Petersburg, and his service at court with its tedious formalities. All that life suddenly filled Pierre with unexpected loathing. He avoided the society of brother Masons, took to visiting the club again, and to drinking a great deal. Associated once more with the gay bachelor companions, and began to lead a life so dissipated that Countess Elena Vasilievna thought it necessary to make severe observations to him on the subject. Pierre felt that she was right, and to avoid compromising his wife, he went away to Moscow. All Moscow society, from the old ladies to the children, welcomed Pierre back like a long-expected guest, whose place was always ready for him, and had never been filled up. For the Moscow world, Pierre was the most delightful, kind-hearted, intellectual, good-humoured, and generous eccentric, and a heedless and genial Russian gentleman of the good old school. His purse was always empty, because it was always open to everyone. Pierre no longer suffered from moments of despair, melancholy and loathing for life as he had done. But the same malady that had manifested itself in acute attacks in former days was driven inwards and never now left him for an instant. What for? What's the use? What is it that is going on in the world? He asked himself in perplexity several times a day, instinctively beginning to sound the hidden significance in the phenomena of life. But knowing by experience that there was no answer to these questions, he made haste to try and turn away from them, took up a book, or hurried off to the club to chat over the scandals of the town. Countess Ellen, who has never cared for anything but her own body and is one of the stupidest women in the world, Pierre thought, is regarded by people as this acme of wit and refinement, and is the object of their homage. Napoleon Bonaparte was despised by everyone while he was really great, and since he became a pitiful buffoon, the Emperor Francis seeks to offer him his daughter in an illegal marriage. The Spaniards, through their Catholic Church, return thanks to God for their victory over the French on the 14th of June, and the French, through the same Catholic Church, return thanks to God for their victory over the Spaniards on the same 14th of June. My Masonic brothers swear in blood that they are ready to sacrifice all for their neighbour, but they don't give as much as 1 ruble to the collections for the poor, and the intrigue between Austria and the Manor Seekers, and are in a ferment with the authentic Scottish rug, and an act of which the man who wrote it did not know the meaning, and no one has any need. We all profess the Christian law of forgiveness of sins and love for one's neighbour, the law in honour of which we have raised 40 times 40 churches in Moscow. But yesterday we knouted to death a deserter, and the minister of that same law of love and forgiveness, the priest, gave the soldier the cross to kiss before his punishment. Such were Pierre's reflections, and all this universal deception, recognized by all, used as he was to seeing it, was always astounding him, as though it were something new. I understand this deceit and tangle of cross purposes, he thought. But how am I to tell them all I understand? I have tried, and always found that they understood it as I did, at the bottom of their hearts, but were only trying not to see it. So I suppose it must be so. But me? What refuge is there for me? Thought Pierre. Sometimes Pierre remembered what he had been told of soldiers under fire in ambuscade, when they have nothing to do, how they try hard to find occupation so as to bear their dangers more easily. And Pierre pictured all men as such soldiers, trying to find a refuge from life, some in ambition, some in cards, some in framing laws, some in women, some in playthings, some in horses, some in politics, some in sport, some in wine, some in the government service. Nothing is trivial. Nothing is important. Everything is the same. Only to escape from it as best one can, thought Pierre. Only not to see it. That terrible it. Count Ilya Andreyevich Rostov arrived in Moscow towards the end of January with Natasha and Sonya. The Countess was unwell and unable to travel, but they could not put off coming till she recovered, for Prince Andrei was expected in Moscow every day. They had, besides, to order the trousseau, to sell the estate in the suburbs of Moscow, and to take advantage of the old Prince Bolkonsky's presence in Moscow to present his future daughter-in-law to him. The Rostovs' house in Moscow had not been heated all the winter, and as they were coming only for a short time and the Countess was not with them, Count Ilya Andreyevich made up his mind to stay with Maria Dmitrievna Orosimov, who had long been pressing her hospitality upon the Count. Next day, by the advice of Maria Dmitrievna, Count Ilya Andreyevich went with Natasha to call on Prince Nikolai Andreyevich. The Count prepared for the visit by no means in a cheerful spirit. In his heart he was afraid. Count Ilya Andreyevich had a vivid recollection of his last interview with the old prince at the time of the levying of the militia, when, in reply to his invitation to dinner, he had had to listen to a heated reprimand for furnishing less than the required number of men. Natasha, in her best dress, was, on the contrary, in the most cheerful frame of mind. "They can't help liking me," she thought. "Everyone always does like me. And I'm so ready to do everything they please for them, so ready to love them. Him for being his father, and her for being his sister. They can have no reason for not loving me." When they drove to the gloomy old house in Vozdvizhenka, the first person to meet the visitors was Mademoiselle Bourienne. She greeted the father and daughter with marked courtesy and conducted them to the princess's apartment. From the first glance, Princess Maria disliked Natasha. She thought her too fashionably dressed, too frivolously gay and vain. Apart from this insuperable feeling of antipathy to her, Princess Maria was at that moment agitated by the fact that, on the Rostovs having been announced, the old prince had shouted that he didn't want to see them. That Princess Maria could see them if she chose, but they were not to be allowed in to see him. "Dear Natasha," said Princess Maria, "do believe how glad I am my brother has found such happiness." She paused, feeling she was telling a lie. Natasha noticed the pause and guessed the reason for it. After 5 minutes of irksome and constrained conversation, they heard the sound of slippered feet approaching rapidly. Princess Maria's face expressed horror. The door of the room opened and the prince came in a white nightcap and dressing gown.
"Oh, Madame," he began. "Madame Countess, Countess Rostov, if I'm not mistaken, I beg you to excuse me, I didn't know, Madame, as gods above, I didn't know that you were deigning to visit us, and came into my daughter in this costume. I beg you to excuse me, as gods above, I didn't know," he repeated, so unnaturally, with emphasis on the word God, and so unpleasantly, that Princess Maria rose to her feet with her eyes on the ground, not daring to look either at her father or at Natasha. "I beg you to excuse me, I beg you to excuse me, as gods above, I didn't know," muttered the old man, and looking Natasha over from head to foot, he went out. That evening, the Rostovs went to the opera, for which Maria Dmitrievna had obtained them a box. Natasha had no wish to go, but it was impossible to refuse after Maria Dmitrievna's kindness, especially as it had been arranged expressly for her.
When she was dressed and waiting for her father in the big hall, she looked at herself in the big looking-glass and saw that she was looking pretty. Very pretty. She felt even sadder, but it was a sweet and tender sadness.
My God, if he were only here, thought Natasha, and what does it matter to me about his father and sister? I'll love no one but him, with that face and those eyes, with his smile, manly and yet childlike. No, better not think of him, not think, forget, utterly forget him for the time. I can't bear the suspense. I shall sob in a minute.
And she turned away from the looking-glass, making an effort not to weep.
And how can Sonya love Nikolenka so quietly, so calmly, and wait so long and so patiently? She wondered,
looking at Sonya, who came in, dressed for the theatre with a fan in her hand.
No, she's utterly different. I can't.
Natasha at that moment felt so softened and moved that to love and know that she was loved was not enough for her. She wanted now, at once, to embrace the man she loved and to speak and hear from him the words of love of which her heart was full. When she was in the carriage, sitting beside her father and pensively watching the lights of the street lamps flitting by the frozen window, she felt even sadder and more in love and forgot with whom and where she was going. The Rostovs' carriage drove up to the theatre, its wheels crunching slowly over the snow. Natasha and Sonya skipped hurriedly out, holding up their dresses. The Count stepped out, supported by the footman, and all three walked to the corridor for the boxes in the stream of ladies and gentlemen going in and people selling programmes. They could hear the music already. The two strikingly pretty girls, Natasha and Sonya, with Count Ilya Andreyitch, who had not been seen for a long while in Moscow, attracted general attention. Moreover, everyone had heard vaguely of Natasha's engagement to Prince Andrei and looked with curiosity at the girl who was to make one of the best matches in Russia. Natasha had, so everyone told her, grown prettier in the country, and that evening, owing to her excited condition, she was particularly pretty. She made a striking impression of fullness of life and beauty, together with indifference to everything around her. Her black eyes gazed at the crowd, seeking out no one, while her slender arm, bare to above the elbow, leaned on the velvet edge of the box, and her hand, holding the programme, clasped and unclasped in time to the music, with obvious unconsciousness.
"Look, there's Elenina," said Sonya, "with her mother, isn't it?"
"Heavens, Pierre Bezukhov is really stouter than ever," said the old Count.
"Look, our Anna Mihalovna, in such a cap."
"The Karagins, Julie, and Boris with them. One can see at once they're engaged." "Trubetskoy has made his offer, to be sure. I heard so today," said the old Count.
Natasha looked in the direction her father was looking in and saw Julie with diamonds on her neck. Her thick, red neck, Natasha knew it was powdered, sitting with a blissful face beside her mother. Behind them could be seen the handsome, well-brushed head of Boris, with a smile inclining his ear towards Julie's mouth. He looked from under his brows at the Rostovs and said something, smiling, to his betrothed.
"They are talking about us, about me, and himself," thought Natasha. "And he is, most likely, soothing his fiancée's jealousy of me. They needn't worry themselves. If only they knew how little they matter to me, any of them."